Gideon. One of my best loved Bible stories from childhood was this story of Gideon, and I'm sure we all know the story rather well. However, the quirk about stories like this one is that we retain a partial image in our minds based on two limiting factors. A, we heard limited or watered down versions of these when we were children. And B, it's also part of our fleshly nature that we tend to retain only certain highly visual points, and we forget a lot of the other details. So I thought we might take some time today to revisit the story and to refresh our memories about the details and perhaps find a few pictures within that maybe you haven't considered or you haven't considered recently. And so we will lay out our thoughts today in three parts. First of all, when and where did the story take place? In other words, what were the circumstances at this time? Who was Gideon? Why was he chosen? And then, of course, the events of the confrontation or battle and its immediate aftermath. So first of all, the when and where of it. There are a few details we can determine pretty quickly. For example, at the time the story occurs, the tribes are scattered across the Promised Land. We know that this is after the Exodus, therefore. This is after the Hebrews entered the land to claim it, and it's after it was divided amongst the tribes by Joshua, according to the instructions provided him by God. But since this is the period of Judges, we also know that these events take place before the time of the kings, which would have begun with King Saul. Given a lack of specific dates or easy to pinpoint facts, one estimate of the timing of the events of the Judges places them between 1200 and 1020 BC, which is a span of approximately 180 years. And this is based on evidence from the arrival of the Israelites into the Promised Land, as well as best guesses for the start of the reign of King Saul. It's worth pointing out that if we were to add all the time periods mentioned within Judges, we would obtain a number somewhere between 410 and 430 years. So the best answer we've seen to what appears to be a conflict is that these are not events laid end to end, but rather the events of the Judges were occurring during sometimes overlapping periods scattered across the land. Again, without concrete archaeological evidence, and that's limited because these are not well-recorded or documented events, precise dating is unlikely to be possible. For a few interesting reference points, I always like to put this in a context of the kind of what you might call otherworldly history. It's worth mentioning that it's believed that the Trojan War took place somewhere around the beginning of this span of time. And we also know when we talk about certain ages of development, we talk about the Iron Age, which would have begun in 1100 with the development of iron usage in Austria, and that spread throughout Europe. Furthermore, another kind of interesting point is there's evidence historically that an Icelandic volcano erupted around this time frame, and it was not just an ordinary volcano eruption. It was seven times greater than that of Mount St. Helens back in 1980. And this is primarily interesting as a potential link to climate change that was known to have impacted weather patterns across the world and which may have been responsible for droughts and famines and general population movement at that time. And that cause for population movement we think is significant, perhaps in our story, because we know that in the middle of all of this, we're told that the Midianites had come to the land inhabited by the Israelites and life was made very difficult as a result. So we'll read in Judges chapter 6, verses 1 through 6. Then the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. The power of Midian prevailed against Israel. Because of Midian, the sons of Israel made for themselves the dens which were in the mountains and the caves and the strongholds. For it was when Israel had sown that the Midianites would come up with the Amalekites and the sons of the east and go against them. So they would camp against them and destroy the produce of the earth as far as Gaza and leave no sustenance in Israel, as well as no sheep, ox, or donkey. For they would come up with their livestock and their tents They would come in like locusts for number. Both they and their camels were innumerable, and they came into the land to devastate it. So Israel was brought very low because of Midian, and the sons of Israel cried to the Lord. Time after time, God's chosen people fell into the same traps and temptations. Even at the end of the book of Judges, after all these amazing stories of God's deliverance, we're told in Judges chapter 21, verse 25, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now, this is an interesting passage because you could kind of read it two ways. The first way, the obvious way, is that it was a case of every man for himself. Or you might even describe it as survival of the fittest. We might imagine this as a period of something like anarchy. Or it might be likened to the present day, wherein we are all casting about and looking for the right way to be. Some of us are letting the flesh rule and seeking personal gain, or at the very least focusing on losing less than the next person. Others are perhaps trying to do the right thing. But we know even then we are going to fail because we are imperfect. And if we doubt this, we only have to look at our economy, our politics, our educational and healthcare systems. And so we imagine that life was made more difficult in their day due to the lack of structure and the lack of leadership. And furthermore, we could also imagine that one of the primary lessons for the Hebrews in keeping and reading the book of Judges was this need for a leader and a guide. Some might think that that meant a king, for example, Saul, but even that didn't work out very well for them. The better conclusion was not the need for a human king, but rather the need for the ultimate Lord of all, their God. But I promised two readings of the passage. No king in Israel, everyone doing what was right in their own eyes. We could also imagine this as a foreshadowing of the ultimate goal for mankind. We look forward to and pray for that day when God's promise from Jeremiah 31, verses 33 to 34 comes to pass. But this is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. They will not teach again, each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, know the Lord, for they will all know me. From the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquities, and their sin I will remember no more. Now, even though Israel had forgotten their promises to God when they first were granted entry into the promised land, nothing provides a better reminder than that moment when everything is against you. And so the Midianites came like locusts, and the Israelites called out to God because of their suffering. And his response in Judges 6, verses 7 through 10 was essentially, you brought this on yourself through your actions. But then an angel of the Lord came to Gideon. Now, we don't have a great deal of background provided for Gideon. We do know he was the son of Joash the Abiezrite, and we know that he came from a clan of Manasseh. There's also reason to suspect that the division of the land, as described at the end of the book of Joshua, with each tribe inhabiting its own region, was more theoretical than actual reality. Scholars point out that the ideal picture of the 12 tribes, each in its own place, seems to have never really materialized. And the blame for this would seem to be the failure of the nation to complete the conquest of Canaan, as commanded by God. Because of this incomplete conquest, the remainder of tribes were often forced to defend themselves against neighboring countries, and in some cases were forced to migrate away from their promised regions. This, in turn, created a great deal of religious and moral pressure on the Israelites. Because they were living around and among the Canaanites, they were exposed to their customs and religion. With constant exposure came more and more opportunity to bend a little and adopt the belief in the polytheism of the Canaanites. And this led to something called syncretism. You may not be familiar with the word, but you are definitely familiar with the consequences. We live with the consequences of syncretism today. That's why we associate a tree with the Christmas holiday, because pagans used to burn a huge Yule log when celebrating the winter solstice. This is why our celebration of the resurrection is called Easter, which was originally Ishtar, the Assyrian and Babylonian goddess of fertility. And it's the reason we think about eggs and bunnies. In similar fashion, the pagan beliefs and traditions crept in and corrupted the pure beliefs of the Israelites. Therefore, throughout the book of Judges, what we find is a mixture of tribes and a mixture of Canaanites influencing them. There's no doubt this contributes to the state of things and the need for these judges to remind the people of their one true God. So while Gideon was certainly from a clan of Manasseh, we're not positive he actually lived in the region of Manasseh. If we look up the city of Ophrah, we find no concrete record of such a city actually being in Manasseh. There were two cities by that name in Ephraim and Benjamin. Neither of those actually even seems to fit the events of the story. And so the best guess of some historians is that the city in question was actually found in or very near Issachar, near the valley of Jezreel. And that's really all we can do at this point is formulate a best guess. But it's a very intriguing guess, and it makes a lot of sense for our story. For one thing, the Jezreel Valley has another name you might be familiar with, the Valley of Megiddo. It's commonly agreed that its location was of great strategic importance, for it was located at the crossroads of two common military and trade routes. One between Egypt and Mesopotamia, and the other connecting Jerusalem with cities of Phoenicia. So this was an important region, a region that an army would have sought to control. Perhaps then it is no surprise that Megiddo was the site of many, many settlements. Archaeologists believe they have found evidence of 20 cities there, one right on top of the other. With such a history of destruction, what better picture of a mighty battle than the Hill of Megiddo? Since the prefix Har means hill in Hebrew, that would be Har Megiddo, which we believe is where we get the title Armageddon. If we circle back to the 7 years of conflict stirred up by the Midianites, we can perhaps understand the scene we find in Judges 6, verses 11 and 12. Then the angel of the Lord came and sat under the oak that was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, as his son Gideon was beating out wheat in the winepress in order to save it from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said to him, "The Lord is with you, O valiant warrior." Do you think the angel was mocking Gideon when he called him, "O valiant warrior"? This doesn't seem to be in character with the communication from God. And so if we take it at face value, we're already told to expect Gideon to be ready to fight on behalf of the Lord. But it raises a question. If he is so valiant, why is he beating out wheat in the wine press? You know, the wine presses were these kind of indentations into the earth often, perhaps a building, but sometimes they were just built right into the earth. And it would have been this hidden hole, so to speak. Why is he not doing it in the open? This gives more support to this idea that the Midianites were not to be trifled with. Even the most loyal to God, which we would suspect Gideon was, and the most valiant of Israelites, was forced to work in secret for fear of running afoul of the Midianite troops. And this is, of course, where the story gets rather familiar. Judges 6, verses 13 through 16. Then Gideon said to him, "O my Lord, if the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us up from Egypt?' But now the Lord has abandoned us and given us into the hand of Midian." The Lord looked at him and said, "Go in this your strength and deliver Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?" He said to him, "O Lord, how shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my father's house." But the Lord said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat Midian as one man." Gideon is living in a time where God's miracles only exist in stories told by their fathers. And so he is cautious when a messenger comes with this command. I think he wants to believe. But how does one recognize the angel of the Lord? And he also shows wonderful humility in verse 15 when he says, "How shall I deliver Israel? Behold, my family is the least in Manasseh, and I am the youngest in my father's house." But we know that is exactly how God works. When Samuel was sent to the family of Jesse to find and anoint the king of Israel to replace Saul, He was warned to not look at appearances as man would see them. God chooses his servants by looking at their heart condition. And then there's one of my favorite scriptures from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 26 through 28. For consider your calling, brethren, that there were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. But God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he may nullify the things that are. The very reason that made Gideon question his ability to meet the Lord's needs are the same reasons or the same things that made him a perfect choice. And next, Gideon does something quite interesting. Judges chapter 6, verses 17 through 21. So Gideon said to him, if now I have found favor in your sight, then show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Please do not depart from here until I come back to you and bring out my offering and lay it before you. And he said, I will remain until you return. Then Gideon went in and prepared a young goat and unleavened bread from an ephah of flour. He put the meat in a basket and the broth in a pot and brought them out to him under the oak and presented them. The angel of God said to him, take the meat and the unleavened bread and lay them on this rock and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of the Lord put out the end of the staff that was in his hand and touched the meat and the unleavened bread, and fire sprang up from the rock and consumed the meat and the unleavened bread. Then the angel of the Lord vanished from his sight. So we'll talk about several aspects of this passage, but first let us focus on verse 17 again. Show me a sign that it is you who speak with me. Now, how do we read this? Is he doubting the Lord? Is he displaying a lack of faith in asking this question? If we believe that, wouldn't we expect the Lord to reprimand him? And yet there is no reprimand recorded. I would suggest instead that what this is just caution. Surely to have the Lord fight on the side of Israel again, as in the stories of old, is something Gideon truly desires. I believe he wants to be sure he isn't merely wanting this to be true in his flesh. He is saying, in essence, if you really are the messenger of the one true God, show me your signet ring. Show me that sign that could only come from God. And the next interesting part is the sign that is shown. He prepares a goat and unleavened bread and broth. We think it is not a coincidence that both the goat and the unleavened bread, prepared with an ephah of flour, are symbols used in the sin offering of the temple. And what better thing to offer in this land where God had largely been abandoned? This was a symbol of the righteousness that had been lost and that God wanted to rekindle again in their hearts. There is a picture here of consecration. As Gideon was, we live in a world where God has largely been forgotten. We believe and we try to do what is right in our understanding. And one day he calls to us. We recognize that he wants us to willingly serve him. We consider the cost and we recognize that it is truly our desire. And so we offer what we have, little though it be. And in this same way, Gideon recognizes his desire to serve the Lord and offers what he has in accordance with the Lord's will. And there's a third component of this that really jumps out at us. How is the offering handled? The angel of the Lord has him place the meat and unleavened bread on a rock and pours the broth over them, and then he consumes them with fire. Where have we seen an offering like that before? If we look in 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 31 through 35 and then 38, we read, Elijah took 12 stones according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, Israel shall be your name. So with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. There's a recurring theme here where the Lord wants to make it clear that his miracles are above and beyond the expectations of man. He leaves no room to doubt his involvement. This applies not only to the consumption of a burnt offering, despite it being drenched in liquid. We will also see this apply to the means by which Gideon and his men, of course, will overcome the Midianites. There's one more piece we want to talk about before we get to the core of the story. Back in Judges 6, verses 25 through 31 now. Now on the same night, the Lord said to him, take your father's bull and the second bull, 7 years old, and pull down the altar of Baal, which belongs to your father, and cut down the Asherah that is beside it. Wait, we're going to pause here and highlight this. He is cutting down the altar of Baal, which belongs to his father? This is a little strange. It sounds almost crazy. How does a righteous Gideon come from a family that has an altar to Baal? Now, unfortunately, we're left with really only speculation, but it would seem his father is actually not particularly invested in Baal. We're going to see that in a moment. So maybe he was grudgingly allowing family members or servants to build such an altar. Maybe he was trying to avoid the wrath of the Midianites. It's difficult to say, but it would seem that it was not particularly dear to Gideon or his father. If we read on, build an altar to the Lord your God on the top of this stronghold in an orderly manner, and take a second bull and offer a burnt offering with the wood of the Asherah, which you shall cut down. Then Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had spoken to him. And because he was too afraid of his father's household and the men of the city to do it by day, he did it by night. So right there, I think we already point out to who values this altar. It's not the father, it's the father's household and the men of the city. When the men of the city arose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was torn down, and the Asherah, which was beside it, was cut down, and the second bull was offered on the altar which had been built. They said to one another, who did this thing? And when they searched about and inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, did this thing. Then the men of the city said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die, for he has torn down the altar of Baal, and indeed he has cut down the Asherah which was beside it. But Joash said to all who stood against him, will you contend for Baal, or will you deliver him? Whoever will plead for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because someone has torn down his altar. Now, there are more details here than we really have answers for, and we leave a lot of these for your further study. But some of this is very clear. In destroying these altars to Baal, Gideon is accomplishing two things. He's taking the first step in cleansing the land of idolatry. He's making a statement to the locals who have been violating the commandment to have no other gods before Jehovah. And he's no doubt provoking the Midianites as well. He is also cutting down a pagan grove of trees and using this to create an altar to the Lord on which those two bulls were offered. And my favorite part of this passage is the response of his father when the townspeople come for Gideon in the morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself. Essentially, if Baal is so great, surely he can take care of punishing Gideon himself. Those don't really sound like the words of a man who believed in worshiping Baal, do they? And now we come to the truly familiar portion of the story, the bit that we all learned in Sunday school and the bit that I think most readily comes to mind. Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the sons of the east assembled themselves, and they crossed over and camped in the valley of Jezreel. Remember, this is also the valley of Megiddo. So the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon, and he blew a trumpet, and the Abiezrites, his own clan members, were called together to follow him. He sent messengers throughout Manasseh, and they also were called together to follow him, and he sent messengers to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet them. It seems his provocation in destroying the pagan sites has had its intended effect. The enemies of Israel have all gathered together in the valley of Megiddo, or Jezreel, and he calls all the local tribes to his aid. Now, a quick glance at a map of the division of the land leads to an interesting question. Is this part of the country, or rather in this part of the country, there were 5 of the tribes living closely together, Asher, Issachar, Manasseh, Naphtali, and Zebulun. And yet we are told he only called four of those. If you look at that list from a moment ago, there's an intriguing question. Why is Issachar not being mentioned? We have no definitive answers, but perhaps a couple speculations. Maybe Issachar was completely occupied by the Midianites and could not mobilize. I don't love this answer, but it has been suggested. Or possibly all the men of Issachar already knew because the Abiezrites and the locals were already within the territory of Issachar. This might provide some rationale as to why they aren't mentioned, because they're already included. One thing that is important to highlight is that the call went out to these four or perhaps five regions, and men from all of these areas answered the call. So even though the nation had fallen away, there were those ready to heed the call and fight for the land and the Lord. They were individual tribes, and yet they were still a nation. And this is another nice picture for us. As they were, we are all individuals. And yet we are all part of one group that follows the Lord. And then we come to Gideon putting out the fleece. Judges 6, verses 36 through 40. Gideon said to God, "If you will deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the threshing floor. If there is dew on the fleece only, and it is dry on all the ground, then I will know that you will deliver Israel through me, as you have spoken." And it was so. When he arose early the next morning and squeezed the fleece, he drained the dew from the fleece, a bowl full of water. Then Gideon said to God, "Do not let your anger burn against me, that I may speak once more. Please let me make a test once more with the fleece. Let it now be dry only on the fleece, and let there be dew on all the ground." God did so that night, for it was dry only on the fleece, and the dew was all on the ground. Now, we might ask, didn't Gideon already have an earlier sign? Was it not enough for him that the Lord consumed his offering of goat and broth and unleavened bread? This can be a challenging passage to explain if we interpret his request as indecision or hesitance to follow the Lord. But as before, if he was doing this from an incorrect heart attitude, we would expect to see the Lord rebuke him. Yet this is not what occurred. Therefore, we would propose an alternate explanation. Instead of uncertainty in God's plan, could it have been that Gideon was uncertain he was taking the appropriate actions to achieve God's victory? The first request was to make sure his understanding was aligned with the Father's, and the second was to be sure he was reading the sign correctly. A wet fleece was perhaps not completely unnatural in the way a fire consuming his earlier offering would have been. When we're unsure of his leading, there's nothing incorrect about seeking to confirm our understanding. If Gideon's motivation was from a pure heart and with the intent of better understanding the Lord's will, this is another lesson for us on how we ought to approach our Heavenly Father. When we consider our action of putting out the fleece, are we, as we attempt to understand the Lord's will in our lives today, in what manner are we doing so? Are we asking about whether or not we should take that job or buy that house? Or are we doing so with a focus on spiritual concerns? When we seek his guidance and direction, it should be for things like, should I consecrate my life in his service? Or should I take on this witnessing task? Is this service I wish to offer going to allow me to better glorify his name? When we are attempting to preach the gospel, we know in our hearts that this is the right general course, but perhaps the decision of when, where, and how could use some direction from the Holy Spirit. I'd also like to point out that Gideon had an army of 32,000 men and an order from God to destroy the Midianites. But still he asked for direction. Sometimes knowing what you should be doing is not the same as knowing how you should be doing it. It's also interesting to note that God did not reveal the next step of his plan to Gideon until after Gideon had confirmed and truly felt he understood God's will. God waited until Gideon was in the right position and frame of mind to hear, to believe, and understand what would be asked of him. And this was important because by human estimation, the next instructions would have appeared to be folly. If we compare the numbers in the respective armies, we see that the Midianites totaled around 135,000 men, and the Israelites with Gideon totaled 32,000. The Israelites were outnumbered by greater than 4 to 1. And yet we read in Judges 7, verses 2 and 3. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give Midian into their hands, for Israel would become boastful, saying, 'My own power has delivered me.' Now therefore, come, proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, 'Whoever is afraid and trembling, let him return and depart from Mount Gilead.'" So 22,000 people returned, but 10,000 remained. What is God saying here? It seems he is saying beating those kind of odds is difficult and would be impressive, but it would be too easy for the Israelites to delude themselves and believe that they somehow did it all under their own power. God would not permit this. This is not unlike the consumption of Gideon's sacrifice or the consumption of Elijah's sacrifice. When God is going to display his power, he is going to make sure you know it was him. This calls to mind Ezekiel chapter 38. We won't read it in its entirety, but I'll quickly summarize. This is the prophecy of Gog coming from the north, bringing many nations with them to advance against Israel. And in verse 16, he says, "And you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It shall come about in the last days that I will bring you against my land so the nations may know me when I am sanctified through you before their eyes, O Gog." This is just another place where God will make his presence known in such a way that no one will be able to doubt his involvement. Now, do we ever fall into this trap? Is it possible that we encounter challenges where we need the Lord's assistance, but then afterwards we allow our flesh to rationalize the situation and we tell ourselves, "Oh, that wasn't so bad after all. I guess I was able to handle it." You might say that the greatest challenge in these moments is to recognize God's assistance when it is subtle. But in the case of Gideon, he is not going to permit it to be subtle. He will not permit them to miss the fact that it is entirely God's intervention that is delivering them from the Midianites. And just as we grow spiritually and we recognize more and more his leading as we have continued experience with it, and as our faith grows through those experiences, so it was with Gideon. First, he had to believe that the Lord had called upon him to be the tool that destroyed the Midianites. Then he had to believe that this army was really the Lord's will. And then he had to whittle down the numbers. First, when 22,000 departed because they were afraid. And then in verses 4 and 7 of Judges 7, the Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many. Bring them down to the water and I will test them for you there. Therefore it shall be that he of whom I say to you, 'This one shall go with you,' he shall go with you. But everyone of whom I say to you, 'This one shall not go with you,' he shall not go." So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "You shall separate everyone who laps the water with his tongue as a dog laps, as well as everyone who kneels to drink." Now the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people kneeled to drink water. The Lord said to Gideon, "I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped and will give the Midianites into your hands. So let all the other people go, each man to his home." There were really two purposes served in this final reduction. Most obviously, the numbers were reduced a final time in order to make God's part in this unmistakable. However, those who cupped the water in their hands were also displaying a practicality and a watchfulness which identified them as worthy of the great task which would be set before them. This task would require alertness, discipline, and trust in their leader. You might think that after the various signs and interactions Gideon had with God through his mouthpiece, that Gideon would have been sufficiently ready to take on the Midianites. But we read that Gideon's faith was strengthened one more time when he was encouraged to sneak into the camp of the enemy, where he overheard a soldier speaking of a dream. Judges chapter 7, verses 10, 11, and 13 through 15. "But if you are afraid to go down," and this is God speaking to Gideon, "if you're afraid to go down, go with Purah, your servant, down to the camp, and you will hear what they say, and afterward your hands will be strengthened that you may go down against the camp." So he went with Purah, his servant, down to the outpost of the army that was in the camp. When Gideon came, behold, a man was relating a dream to his friend, and he said, "Behold, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread was tumbling into the camp of Midian, and it came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat. His friend replied, "This is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given Midian and all the camp into his hand." When Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, he bowed in worship. He returned to the camp of Israel and said, "Arise, for the Lord has given the camp of Midian into your hands." Now, pause for a moment and imagine what this must have felt like. How does a conversation like that come to pass in the enemy camp? This is a camp that outnumbered the Israelites 4-1 before Gideon sent most of them home. And yet somehow they all know in this camp exactly who Gideon is, even though he's the youngest son of the weakest house in Manasseh. And somehow the dream is clearly interpreted by the other soldier as Gideon come to destroy them through the power of God. Just the fact that this conversation happened was already a miracle in and of itself. And the rest, of course, is very well known, and we're not really going to spend a great deal of time on it. They separated into three groups of 100 on three sides of the Midianites in the darkness. They each blew a trumpet and displayed their hidden torches and caused such terror and confusion amongst the Midianites that they largely slew themselves before running for the hills. And then Gideon summoned assistance from the surrounding regions, Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, and Ephraim. At the same time, Gideon and his 300 pursued another group of Midianites and captured and slew them. There were some more details in there you might not recall, but unfortunately we don't have time to dig into all of this today. We do, however, want to focus on the end of the story. When the fighting was over, the Israelites wanted to appoint Gideon as their ruler and his son after him. They were essentially trying to establish him as a king, but he declined. Judges 8:23, Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." He did, however, take an earring from each as spoil. He melted it down and constructed an ephod from the gold, placing it in Ophrah. And it should not surprise any of us that, as with the golden calf in the wilderness, the Israelites once again succumbed to the urge to worship this item. I think one lesson there for us is that when you're around sin and falsehood your entire life, it is so easy to underestimate the power it holds over your decisions. How do the Israelites go from a victory of 300 over 135,000 soldiers and then slide back into sin? It's a slow process, and it no doubt snuck up on them. With a slight weakening of their resolve here, and maybe wanting to be a little bit more like their neighbors over there, we're told in Judges 8, verses 28 to 35, Judges 8, 28 to 35, that for 40 years there was peace in the land, which was the remainder of Gideon's lifetime. During that time, he had 70 sons born to many wives. And then we're told in verse 33 of Judges 8, the Israelites returned to the worship of Baal. Nor did they show loyalty to his family, despite the good he had done for Israel. Well, brethren, we've covered a lot of ground here. So I'd like to summarize just a few points I'd like you to take with you. The first is that as Israel floundered during the period of the judges and lacking leadership, so we recognize the world floundering today. But we have a hope that one day the great judge and king over all will lead us. We know that the Lord is calling us, just as he called to Gideon. He wants willing servants to be molded and shaped into tools to be used by him. And just like tools, we have no value without the master that puts us to use. When we seek his direction in our lives and put out the fleece, it is important that we do it for the right reasons. We don't need to seek his will for worldly concerns, but rather for spiritual concerns to help us better glorify our Father. We do well to remember that his strength is made perfect in our weakness. And so we work to serve as best we can, despite our obvious faults, knowing and trusting that our only job is to show up and to do with all our might whatever our hands find to do. Ecclesiastes 9:10. The victory is always the Lord's. And lastly, we should remember how easy it is to fall away, even for those that were present at such a miraculous victory. When we are surrounded by error and the temptations of the flesh on a daily basis, it takes constant vigilance to maintain our path in the narrow way. While this is a story we all know, I hope that some of you enjoyed revisiting it as I did. And I hope that I've called to mind for you some things you maybe had not considered, or at least not considered recently, or things you may have forgotten. And so we're grateful to our Father for his leading. Amen.